Welcome to this episode of The Wolf and the Shepherd. Today we're going to talk about a world of their own. And today joining us is Landon Hughes. Landon, glad you could join us.
Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. And, you know, thanks for taking some time out of your day to come here and talk to us about what's going to be an interesting topic. And it's going to be one of those where the wolf typically tries to talk over me and not let me ask questions. But you know what? I'm going to try to interject a little bit more than I normally do.
Well, having said that, I just got there's a low air quality alert.
Oh, so there is.
I might actually have to pause for breathing more often than normal. So just take those chances and kind of jump in.
Yeah, but that's something that's obviously wrong with you. Yeah. But that's topic
allergies.
For another podcast.
Yeah. 14 months a year, allergies.
Yeah.
So Landon, he's a speech therapy supervisor and director of clinical programs at an organization called Therapedia here in Tarrant County in North Texas. My son worked with Landon, or the other way around probably, for a number of years and was incredibly blessed during that time with Landon's devotion and professionalism with the whole of the staff at Therapedia. I know Xander always love to come in see you.
That's great.
And as most of our regular listeners know, my son is 7 years old. He does have autism. And, you know, we are enrolled in various therapy programs. And today we really wanted to kind of discuss some of the approaches to that therapy and really, you know, how you develop on from different facets of those therapies, such as speech, food therapy, all the different type of, what would you call it, Lyme, when you talk about certain behaviors associated with autism, people on autism spectrum?
So I kind of think of, you know, different treatments as, you know, almost like a modality, like different approaches, different methods for how you can treat children with autism. But as you kind of touched on, it's pervasive in all of the areas that it touches. I mean, it doesn't just impact speech. It doesn't just impact behavior. It doesn't just impact feeding, learning, play. I mean, it originally was a pervasive developmental disorder. PDD-NOS was an early name for autism.
What does PDD-NOS stand for?
So pervasive developmental pervasive developmental disorder not otherwise specified.
Okay.
So early on it was kind of a seesaw between, is this a psychological issue? Is it an emotional disorder? And so there's been different iterations of what autism is from a strictly like psychological level based on the different editions of like the DSM, you know.
And what is DSM?
The Diagnostic Statistical Manual of Psychology.
Okay.
I don't know what number they're on right now, if it's the 4 or the 5. But that's how you ended up with this idea of the autism spectrum.
Gotcha.
And so the most recent version of it has actually, it's interesting because it has really just isolated autism by itself, to where you have different levels of autism. And so, you know, that it really has gone into almost giving a severity rating, you know, from the very beginning of like a 1 or a 2 or a 3. And it's my understanding that that's based on the expected level of intervention that the child will require based on their level of function at the time of diagnosis.
Yeah.
So a level 1 is a little bit more severe, and then it moves up to higher levels.
Now, obviously, those levels of diagnosis have, you know, it improved over the year. When I was maybe 3 or 4, I got diagnosed as having a certain form of autism, and 2 of my other brothers did as well. And I did the classical you know, things you associate with autism. You know, I had these repetitive, you know, patterns of behavior. You know, I didn't do the hand flapping thing, but I would lay in bed and rock my head. I would rock to and fro in a chair.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, various things you'd associate it with it. I had speech difficulties
mm-hmm.
up until a certain age.
Well, and that was because you were born in England.
Well, yeah. Now we can understand each other across the street there. So, I mean, that's one thing. But, you know, and then you kind of grow up learning nothing about autism whatsoever unless you know somebody personally who's affected by it.
True.
And, you know, even, you know, with my own son, when you talk to people who don't really know or haven't researched anything about it, everything's lumped into this, they're on the spectrum. And the problem is now the spectrum is so wide that it's like, even if you have somebody, you have a kid who has difficulty paying attention for long periods of time, that they get thrown on the spectrum and everybody, you know, say, as you were saying, Landon, that, you know, you really do have to, with a scalpel, divide up what, you know, kids need, what approach and what types of therapy. There's not a one-size-fits-all mm-hmm. therapy. There's not even a 20-sizes-fits-all approach to it. You really have to almost tailor-make different therapies for every kid.
Absolutely, yeah. That's something that we talk about a lot. There's definitely a saying that probably a lot of people use when you're working in pediatrics and working with kids who have autism. We always say, like, if you've seen one child with autism, you've seen one child mm-hmm. with autism, because
okay. yeah.
none of them are the same. And so the therapy has to be different. The approaches have to be different and unique and creative. And if you attempt, I mean, you can attempt to try certain strategies for sure with multiple kids, especially early on when you're trying to figure out what you're going to be doing in therapy. You know, you have to kind of try different strategies to see what's going to work for each particular child.
Well, that sounds to me like it becomes very difficult to try to figure out what kind of process that you have to provide to this child of, well, this process worked for this child,
mm-hmm.
but it might not work for this child. So now we've got to just kind of punt and try to figure out what's going to work for the next child.
Right.
There's not this set deal of, oh, I've got a cold, so I just get under a blanket, I take some vitamins, I eat some chicken noodle soup, mm-hmm. and next thing you know, I'm over the cold.
Exactly.
There's no set way to quote-unquote cure it.
No, and I would even venture to say that people should be cautious about the idea of curing autism. I think that you can significantly reduce the, you know, the outward, you know, kinds of expressions of autism. But mm-hmm. I think if you were to ask a lot of parents of kids with autism, that's not something that they're really interested in doing every time.
Yeah.
Our goal is not to change who the child is either. We're trying to facilitate a skill that we believe that they are capable of.
Yeah.
Even though maybe when we first see them, you may have other people that would say, I don't know if this child can communicate. I don't know if this child can play in a functional way. I don't know if this child is going to be able to interact with peers or with parents or siblings, but that's our goal.
Sure.
And so, you know, I tell people, regardless of the autism diagnosis, my role as a speech therapist is to help your child communicate. So, you know, a lot of times I have kids that come in without an autism diagnosis, but maybe it's suspected based on the initial evaluation. And over a period of time, maybe that discussion starts to happen about the potential that a child may have autism. And that's something I always tell parents, like, my goal is not to treat autism. My goal is to treat a language disorder or a communication disorder or a language delay. And my goal is still the same. It's to have your child communicate in a way that can be functional and productive.
Yeah. And that, you know, with my own son, you know, his mother and I, when we first got the diagnosis, it does kind of change your entire world because I guess it's like with anything, you go through this worst case scenario, like, you know, will he ever be able to, you know, communicate effectively, be functional in play? Will he be able to dress himself? Will he be able to, you know, even things such as be toilet trained or anything like that, because you're never sure right at the beginning the severity or, you know, how long certain hurdles will take, you know, to overcome. And I think, you know, our biggest worry was because, you know, we had Sandra a little bit later in life than a lot of parents, was that we knew we're not going to be around forever for him. So we want him to be as functional as possible, you know, both in terms of, you know, communication, being able to be, you know, as self-sufficient as possible and be able to perform not just basic tasks, but tasks to live, you know, I hate the word, but, you know, a kind of normal, you know, neurotypical type lifestyle.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that for us has always been the focus, that we want to get him to that point where we can see constant, I don't know if you really want to call it development, but I guess progress and meeting goals.
Improvement.
Yeah, sure. It's hard because, you know, that the whole diagnosis that comes back to begin with is when they don't meet those kind of milestones. And so those milestones are met later on, and we want him to meet all of those milestones,
sure,
which he maybe should have met or, you know, years earlier, but to actually at some point hit those milestones.
Right.
You know, so he can be functional. Because
yeah, everybody you know, wants to see their kid walk at a certain age or talk at a certain
yeah.
age. It's kind of the same thing.
Yeah. And actually, going back a little bit on, and how did you get into this whole thing? Because, I mean, that's I know that, you know, obviously I know a few things about you because I've known you for a number of years. And, you know, I know you played select soccer and probably I think you're the
barely
same age as my very first soccer team I coached in Texas, because you're about 35, 36.
35,
right?
Yeah.
Because it was 85 boys
yeah,
sitting around?
Texas,
yeah,
Texas Lightning 85.
Yeah,
yeah,
yeah, I remember that, and we must have played against you I don't know how many times as well. But how was this something you set your eyes on, or was this just something which kind of, as you got closer to having to choose what type of career or what you wanted to do, just kind of suddenly stood out and spoke to you?
Sure. Well, I did my undergrad. I got a Bachelor of Science in Psychology from Texas A&M. And, you know, the trouble with psychology is that you can't do much with a bachelor's degree. So you pretty much need a PhD in order to do anything that will get you a living with psychology. So my initial thought was that I would get a master's in psychology and do family and marriage counseling. Sorry. And then it was almost time for me to graduate, and my sister is a pediatrician in San Antonio, and she asked me if I had ever thought about speech therapy, because they, you know, have kids that need speech therapy all the time. It's a job that was in demand, and if I was interested in that. So, you know, the thing I liked about psychology was how people learn new skills, how that happens. And so, you know, I was really interested in that. And so that fit right into that category, you know, where you're basically teaching kids how to learn to talk, how to acquire new skills. So I went and got my master's degree from the University of North Texas.
Oh, the UNT.
Yeah.
That's where I went to school.
Oh, yeah. The old Mean Green.
Yeah, the Mean Green.
Yeah. And so after that, well, I've been practicing as a speech therapist for this is my 10th year. So,
wow.
Yeah. But yeah, without that recommendation from my sister, I don't know if I would have landed on speech therapy. as a career. But I'm really, really glad that I did, because, I mean, the variety of things that we see, the variety of settings that you can work in is, I think it's unlike a lot of careers. I mean, the only other thing I can think of that might compare to it is, like, if you are a physician, you know, the idea of a physician that was once a cardiologist and now you're a radiologist, and maybe you go into family practice or something, I don't know. It just lets you have a lot of variety.
Yeah, well, I always thought if I was going to be a doctor, I was going to be a radiologist, because x-rays are black and white and I'm colorblind.
Mm.
So I always thought, well, that's the perfect job for me, because it's all black and white, so I don't have to worry about the colors.
Well, and radiologists just get to sit in a dark room and look at pictures by themselves most of the day.
That's pretty much what he does.
Yeah, that's all I do anyway. So why am I not a radiologist?
There's still time.
Still time.
No,
because you do it online.
No,
I've got a discount.
I'm an old radiologist.
Yeah, you can do it.
Okay. So it's one of those things with all our podcasts that I'm going to look this up and then never do it.
Right. Well, yeah. I mean, I've got a degree in psychosocial kinesiology, and I'm still not entirely sure what it was about.
You can't even spell that.
You know, I do have issues sometimes with the kinesiology bit.
I before E, except
after. Yeah, and then I had my degree before that was business and marketing, and I probably only did about anything, maybe about 2 years worth of that kind of a career path. So both of my degrees have proven to be absolutely useless. So.
Yeah, if that business marketing degree worked out so well, we'd be just like number two under Joe Rogan
right
now.
We'd be swimming in a sea of gold.
Exactly.
Yeah, no clue whatsoever. Now, unlike, I guess, a lot of traditional therapies where benchmarks may be pretty similar for most of the kind of people you see, Is it difficult sometimes to measure or see progress when somebody can't communicate with you their understanding, mm-hmm. even though they might fully understand it? Because I remember when Xander used to come to you, and you know, you would very barely even, you know, say any words whatsoever. Now he'll sing like full lines to songs and stuff. But when somebody can't really communicate to you, or is just so interested in something else which is presented to them, how do you kind of get over that of just, well, I don't know if they're getting what I'm trying to,
Right. I think the thing about, I mean, and in particularly, you know, staying with kids with autism, it is unlike working with some of our other kids that we see. When you're working on a kid for articulation, you know, it's almost like you're going down a checklist of, these are the sounds that we're needing to work on. Mm-hmm. They master a sound, you knock that off the list. You know, let's move to the next sound. Let's progress in this direction. But it is much more subtle and intricate when it comes to kids with autism. You know, I think going back to even the evaluation, I think there is a realization as a therapist, and like you talked about being a parent, where you realize that this is going to be a long-term relationship. And so you just kind of settle in, and you start to, especially at our clinic, we start to look at the entire child. So we have an aspect of speech where, like you said, he initially was not using any words. And there was a lot of frustration, a lot of behavior going on. And so you just start to notice some subtleties. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and for me, it always starts with attention. Mm-hmm. How is the attention? Is it getting more consistent? Are we finding activities that will hold attention for a little bit longer each time? We may not get any words for a good amount of time, but is he imitating something I'm doing with a toy? Are there motor movements that the child is willing to imitate? Are they taking turns with me in play? Are they taking my hand and putting it on top of a toy and asking me to push that button again or to make it play that song another time? You know, it's subtle things. But the tricky part is that you have these standardized assessments that pop up.
Mm-hmm.
And so the thing about standardized assessments is that they don't make standardized assessments on using children with autism to form the sample, the normative sample to make these scores. So we're using tests that were basically made using children that were fairly typically developing to measure children that are, you know, not as typically developing.
Now, why do you think it is that, given that a lot of kids with autism have a level of high functionality that we don't necessarily pick up on very quickly? I mean, in Xander's case, it was with technology. He saw you do one thing one time, he knew how to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, you know, a common thing among parents that, you know, we've got to put this repetition thing to use.
Sure.
You know, and, you know, I mean, just like with this podcast, you know, the moment Xander wants to watch something repetitively, we're going to make him watch like a million times a week the YouTube videos. So we'll get paid through Google AdSense. But
perfect.
It's kind of hard because, you know, they kind of understand it. Isn't it just some sound or just something which triggers? Because, I mean, Xander, I mean, you won't watch a whole episode repeatedly. It'll just be rewinded or listened to 3 or 4 seconds. And there's some trigger in there, and sometimes it's visual and not, you know, acoustic, that he just gets hooked on. And his latest one is he listens to this YouTube video about this woman who's going shopping with her kid, and they're buying healthy foods. And he's been hooked on this for about 2 or 3 weeks. And, you know, I'm not sure what the attraction is. Sometimes I can tell what the attraction is with some stuff, but, you know, I don't dissuade him because he does get to the point where he can repeat a whole sentence or something he's watching and actually use it appropriately.
Okay.
And so I don't dissuade him from doing that. The stuff where it might be garbled a little bit, like I try and not have him watch Rabbit's Invasion anymore, you know, because you can't understand that. I mean, he's been watching that show for like 5 years and I still can't really understand anything in it. So I try and dissuade him from watching that, but something which has basic educational value in there, I don't mind him absorbing, you know, repetitively. But again, I just don't understand why, I guess, that level of repetition just continues again and again and again. When I know full well he understands it's going on with it.
Well, and that, you know, I think you kind of touched on something that, I mean, some people may see that as like a negative thing.
Yeah.
Do
they call it stemming when it's like fulfilling some type of physiological kind?
It can be. Maybe. So maybe initially for Xander, it started out as something that looked interesting.
Mm-hmm.
But like you said, there are certain, we all have these sensory inputs that we're receiving all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And it's giving you some sort of, you know, neurotransmitter hit of some you know, kind. And so there's something appealing about the sound, the visual effect. Maybe it's a motor movement. I mean, we have a lot of kids that like spinning, they like jumping, they like all kinds of things. They'll clap their hands or, you know, stomping their feet and jumping, but stomping their feet really hard when they walk, they like that sensory input that they're receiving. But, you know, I think that, like you said, early on, especially whenever I'm seeing a child, if I can find a pattern of play, I mean, that's kind of Xander's play.
Yeah.
It's not structured. He knows that you're not going to tell him not to do that. So it's like, this is my free time. I can do what I want. You know, this is my iPad and I can watch my video and I can watch it however I want. This isn't dad's movie. Yeah. But if he, you know, but what we can do is identify those patterns and then use it to our advantage.
Yeah.
In order to facilitate something functional. Like you said, like, is he picking up on the language and using it in a way that can be appropriate?
Yeah. Now, have there been many studies that you know of where the state, I don't know, maybe the release of dopamine is different in kids with autism as opposed to regular kids?
That'd be a good thing to look into.
And how they get that kind of reward system, you know?
I mean, the way that I describe it is that we all have little bits of obsessive compulsive disorder. We all have a little bit of sensory processing issues. But we can, part of it is impulse control. We can kind of control our impulse to not do a certain thing at a certain time because we are worried about perception,
right?
And, you know, worried that we might look a certain way or that we know it's not appropriate to do a certain thing in a certain setting. But if you take those concerns away, you know, what are some of the things that people would do? I mean, would you cover your ears in a loud situation? Would you cover your eyes if it was too bright in a room? Would you get up and walk around more often at your job if you didn't think people would kind of say, like, what are you doing right now? Why aren't you at your desk?
Why do you think that's such a hot potato in the world of autism therapy, is the whole SPD, sensory processing disorder? Because some people kind of are absolutely against it, so it doesn't exist. Whereas in neurotypical kids, it's a big thing. You know, they do things for sensory input.
Sure.
And again, I don't know what the dopamine level reward system is when you're a kid to those extents on those things, but you know, you'll find kids, just like whether they're bouncing a ball against a wall or something, there's something which they fixate on, which is either calming, stemming, or something which gives, you know, sometimes it's just the sound of the ball.
Sure.
You know, but it seems to be a very controversial issue in the world of autism treatment.
And I think, you know, we're delving in a little bit into more of an occupational therapy realm. But I work closely with occupational therapists at work. And the trouble is that it's not really recognized by many medical professionals, from what I understand. And it's been a struggle in occupational therapy to get it recognized as a diagnosis.
Yeah.
Because, again, we are looking for underlying issues, and this is kind of where you can get into, is this behavior or is this something else?
Yeah.
So you can view these outward signs of attempts to self-regulate as behavior.
Yeah.
Or you can view them as attempts to regulate your body.
Sure.
And so, especially if you're talking about an occupational therapist whose goal is to help a child regulate their behavior, and to improve their attention, improve their ability to interact appropriately with other children, then that's where the sensory processing comes into effect.
Yeah.
So, I mean, in my therapy, I take that into account on a daily basis.
Mm-hmm.
I look at what is the child sitting in? What is their posture looking like? What is their level of arousal? You know, are they very energetic that day? If a child is really energetic on a certain day, I can tell from the get-go, I'm not going to ask them to sit down at a table.
Sure.
That's just not going to happen.
Yeah.
And, you know, so if you take that to an educational level, there are many kids, I think, where that's not being accounted for.
Mm-hmm.
And they are just looked at as troublemakers with poor attention and with difficulty learning, when it could be that they are having trouble regulating this excess energy.
Yeah.
And it could be excess mental energy, excess physical energy. But we're receiving so much sensory input all the time. And if you don't know what to do with that extra energy, it could erupt.
Yeah, right. So it kind of reminds me of a South Park episode where they were talking about, you know, kids with ADD.
Okay.
And they just said, you know, oh, this kid has attention deficit disorder. And they were trying to do all of these little therapies or whatever, but they realized if they would just smack the kid up the side of the head and say, sit in your desk and pay attention, which, I mean, that's what I was told when I was a kid.
That's what we grew up with.
Yeah. You know, it's like, oh, you're bouncing around, you're doing this, you're not listening to your parents, you're not doing this. Then you get a smack upside the head and you say, you know, straighten up and fly right. So you're saying that was bad?
I'm saying that it is viewed in a different light nowadays because
it's viewed in a different light nowadays, but I mean, is there not part of you that just wants to smack a kid upside the head and say, straighten up and fly right and see if it works?
Well, it's no, but that wouldn't go over well.
Yeah, you'd probably get a lawsuit.
Yes, but also I think again, it depends on your approach. If you think that this is strictly behavior, then you might try that. You might try that and see how far it gets you. But I will say that sensory seeking behavior evolves over time.
Okay.
So it's almost like your body habituates to a certain input. So maybe you find a new video or maybe you find a new song because that other one, it's just not the same as, or maybe, you know, maybe something else has triggered an interest, and so you, a child will stick with that for a while. So maybe the smack upside the head works for a little while.
Sure.
Until it doesn't. Right. Until the child gets older, or until the behaviors start to become aggressive towards you.
Yeah.
And then what? And then, you know, so, I mean, I think that goes back to another thing that we see in therapy is that activities that were successful 1 week, you set it up the exact same way, the exact same time, day, everything. You try it again the next time, they won't touch it.
Yeah. Now, I mean,
and it's just like.
Now, I mean, I kind of understand why the shepherd brought that up because we did grow up in school with that kind of method of aversion therapy, if you will, you know, based upon I guess that there was this not well studied thought that kids react just as well as to punishment as reward. And yeah, I can't tell you how many times, you know, teachers would smack kids upside the head in class. I mean, and it's a form of aversion therapy, or just like even raising the voice and shouting at you. So you're so scared to kind of talk. I mean, and it was a very, you know, I mean, it's a very popular method and there was almost no controversy around that approach for a long, long time.
Absolutely.
So, you know, you also have to get whether something is being done willingly and can't be helped, as opposed to something which somebody is doing because, you know, they're bored or being brattish in it. And it's hard to kind of measure that because I'm not saying that, you know, Xander does something which is wrong, that, oh, it's never his fault, because he's just as capable of being headstrong and stubborn as anybody else. If he wants to do something, doesn't want to do something, and he'll pull the exact same tricks as any neurotypical kid. But, you know, there's always the thing of why dogs are easier to train than cats, and it's because cats
cats are from Canada.
It's the fact that, you know, cats don't associate punishment with they don't have the cause and effect thing that dogs do. Dogs will relate certain trigger words and certain, you know, rewards with specific sets of behavior, whereas cats do not. They completely disassociate, you know, why they got patted for, you know, like peeing on the kitchen floor or whatever. And
Or they're just evil.
Yeah, or they're just evil. It could be that one.
Just cats are evil.
Nobody's going to give you a $50,000 grant to just come out with that.
Exactly. Cats are from Canada. Cats are evil. Yeah. Let's just admit that and move on.
But kids, you know, you do find, you know, I've read a lot about kids with autism. Sometimes, you know, correcting behavior can be difficult because they do disassociate, cause and effect at times.
That can be tough, It can be tough. I mean, call me crazy, but as a therapist,
you're crazy.
You
told me to call you crazy.
We can kind of, we can push the boundaries for 30 minutes. And we get into some situations where there can be like some standoffs of, you know, I really want you to do this activity and I know that you really want to do that activity. But I'm wanting to try to see what this boundary is, kind of what your frustration threshold may be. A lot of times kids will avoid things that have a lot of structure. So in our therapy, we try to be very child-led because, again, I want the child's attention. So if I notice, I mean, but the way I set up a therapy session is I will have kind of a buffet of activities, maybe four things, and I'll see what a child gravitates to towards that day. Yeah. And it may not be what I want them to do, but I want to have the attention. I need to have the attention in order to repeat vocabulary and to get some therapeutic activities in my sessions. I don't want it to be a constant battle between me and the child. But along those lines, you know, I kind of see it as a moment of progress when a child does do something where you're like, you just did that on purpose. You threw that across the room so that I would go get it so that you could go run and grab that toy over there.
Right.
Like you... That was on purpose.
Yeah.
That's cause-effect relationship. You just did that.
They planned that. Sure. They planned that. So, this example, I'm kind of interested in these four things that you're laying out for a kid, right? Do you have some kind of pre-knowledge of those four things you're going to lay out?
Sure.
Or do you just make up these four things for that kid to walk into?
Either or. It depends on how much...
Blind study kid walking in, you know nothing. What four things are you going to lay in front of that kid to try to, you know, start manufacturing this idea of what's going on? What would be those four things you'd lay in front of them?
What's an age range that we're talking
about? Oh, gosh. Yeah, see what happened there. I thought I had a great question.
It's still good.
We're going to go with 7 years old. Is that fair enough? Or do we need a range?
Yeah, no.
Let's go 6 to 9 years old.
6 to 9 years old. Okay, so I know nothing about the child.
It's male.
Okay.
Let's go male. I don't know if that matters.
Sometimes it doesn't.
And identifies as male, believes it's a boy, doesn't have those problems.
I'm definitely going with some cars.
Okay. Definitely. So cars is number one.
Like Hot Wheels,
Matchbox cars. Sure. I don't know if that's aging us right now.
If those are a thing.
But still it was always Hot Wheels and Matchbox.
Yep.
You know, that there was that. You know, a version, you either had Hot Wheels or you had Matchbox cars.
Okay.
So you got the cars. Okay, so cars are number one.
Probably some sort of building activity.
Legos?
Mega Blocks, Legos, Duplos, something along those lines. A board game, maybe Candyland.
Okay.
Trouble. Classic. It's got the proper dice in the middle.
Right.
And I love that. And then I will shoot for something old school like a book. You might be shocked.
Okay.
So I'm not a huge fan of a lot of toys that have sound, lights, things like that,
right.
Because I want to do the talking. I want to interject the vocabulary into the activity. I don't want the activity to talk over me. That is the one thing where I try to have some control. You know, I can introduce what vocabulary words we're talking about if the toy itself is not doing it for me.
Makes sense.
Yeah. And a lot of toys are just overwhelming.
And certainly with the age range you gave, I mean, that would be a very late diagnosis for a child to actually come to a therapist, because
sure.
in terms of introducing the car, that's more about seeing if there's appropriate play. So they're using the car appropriately rather than throwing it like a softball.
Mm-hmm.
And
makes sense.
How important is the early diagnosis? I mean, Xander was very blessed that his mother, the moment, you know, we found out, you know, his diagnosis of autism, that she immediately sought out, you know, as many different,
mm-hmm.
you know, therapies as possible. And he got, you know, very, very early intervention. And, you know, at the beginning, yeah, he wasn't necessarily showing much appropriate play in terms of some things.
Mm-hmm.
But I know there are kids who, for whatever reason, be it whether it be financial, just a lack of access to information, do not get, you know, those services early on. And so that intervention, you know, comes at a bit of a late point. And so you're almost having to reverse engineer with a child you can't necessarily communicate that well with,
mm-hmm.
and kind of try and scrub that whiteboard as clean as possible,
sure.
to kind of rebuild, you know, almost like roadblocks type, you know, approach,
sure.
to, you know.
Yeah, I mean, there, you know, there are behaviors associated with autism. And as age progresses, as you get older, those things can become, like you said, very ingrained. Habits, ways of getting what you want, can result in some poor routines, poor habits, that can be, you know, that can really affect the quality of life of the child and the family and the dynamics and things like that. So yeah, the earlier you can access therapy, the better, because you can start to build the pre-language skills, the play, the attention, the turn-taking, imitation, things like that at an early age. But the hard part, you know, is the communication aspect with the family,
right?
A lot of times this is one of the hardest conversations that we have in our field. I mean, I can't think of one that is more difficult. And so
why is it so hard?
Because you're laying something on a family that is going to affect a lot of things. It's going to affect, you know, potentially long-term aspects of their life. And it's not just the child, you know, it's the siblings, it's the parents, it's grandparents. I mean, it gets a lot of things involved. And so I think families should know that it's not something that gets thrown around lightly. There's a lot of thought that goes into even broaching that subject. I mean, that is not something that we like to do.
That's got to be one of those worst parts of your job, right? Of having that conversation.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, you can do good stuff,
sure.
but having that initial conversation,
yeah.
has to suck.
Yeah.
Well, and it's hard, but it's something that is also one of the most important things that we do. And I think, you know, the whole goal, again, is to help the child. And so, you know, when we meet a family, you know, that isn't at a place where they want to go down that road or hear that as a part of a diagnosis.
But can you say nobody wants to hear that? Right. I mean, anytime you're delivering that news,
well,
nobody wants to hear that news.
Sure.
So, you know, when you got to walk into that room, you know, I'm picturing, you know, a like ER or something like that, and somebody's got to deliver bad news. Oh, somebody's got cancer and they're going to die or whatever. Mm-hmm. It's almost kind of that same thing. You know, you're walking into that room saying, hey, I got some bad news here. Well, I mean, that's got to suck.
There are a million and one worse things you can hear as a parent. Because like the example you just gave, you know, it's a case of life or death with autism. This is just going to be a different life.
It's a different
life. Like both his mother and I were in, I don't know if you want to call it denial, but we, you know, searched for other things that might be causing these type of behaviors.
Well, no, denial is the right word. Yeah. You want to say, well, no, you got it wrong.
Yeah.
He's just, he'll be fine. He's just leave him alone. Just, you know, you know, there's something like that.
Yeah.
So in your position, it's got to kind of suck to be one of those guys to say, hey, you know, that there's going to be something a little different here.
Sure.
And there's going to be a different road you're going to have to travel down.
Right. And the beauty of, for us, delivering that kind of information is ideally you already have some rapport with the family. Yeah, I mean, it's important to know that, you know, there's some trust there and that I am not just jumping to a conclusion here.
Right.
That there are some signals that have led me to even bring this topic up, you know, so, you know, and it can be met in various ways, but again, I always come back to my goal as your speech therapist is to focus on communication. If I have a diagnosis of autism, that will change a lot of things, but it won't change my goals for your child in your therapy. And the other thing is this idea of, you know, the label, that is huge. The idea of the child being labeled with a diagnosis, more and more, I think people are realizing that it can open some doors actually. For your child, especially when it comes to public school and to access to services. There are a lot of things that may not be offered to your child because they only have a certain diagnosis. But if you were to, you know, take that leap and just get an assessment and it comes back and it shows that the conclusion is your child ends up having autism, you know, there are certain resources that become available based on that. Not that you should seek that out in order to access the resources, but, you know, if there is some sort of silver lining that I can say, I mean, you can access additional resources in the school system. You can access additional therapies.
There's one in the Keller Independent School District. I want to say 509, but that's probably not
504.
Right. 504. Yeah. There we go. I know it was 50 something. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'm getting old, man. I can't remember all the numbers.
Sure.
Right. But yeah, you get a 504 on a kid and then all of a sudden they get these extra abilities or extra
accommodations.
There you go. That's the word I was looking for. Yeah. That they can, you know, function as a normal part of society, but maybe they need to, you know, do everything on a computer rather than writing.
Sure.
Which, by the way, I've got to admit, we shouldn't even teach cursive or anything anymore. I mean, everybody's typing everything anyway. So why do we even care about that? Right. But anyway, so I totally get that.
Gotcha.
Now, you know, as a parent of a child with autism, you try and do as much research as possible into things which, other than therapies, can, you know, help your kid, especially in terms of concentration, you know, getting rid of the hyperactivity thing, because, you know, that's not just purely linked to autism. You know, the prevalence of, you know, ADD and ADHD, there's been a lot of studies on diet you know, over the last 10, 15 years and what causes hyperactivity in kids, why so many more kids are getting diagnosed with ADD. And again, if we try and avoid the aversion therapy that the shepherd brought up earlier about getting smacked around the head to make you pay attention, you know, are there any particular studies you've read that, you know, maybe in terms of like gluten-free diets, the introduction of probiotics, that you've seen probably have enough standing to actually give a basis that it maybe at some point will be introduced into treatments pretty much mainstream?
Well, so specific studies, that's hard. I mean, I can't think of one in particular, but what I can say is, again, if we go back to these sensory preferences and kind of a routine, a need for routine, that also goes into the diet of kids with autism. So you end up seeing kids that are kind of snackers, grazers. But there's, again, a particular thing that they like about certain foods. It could be the way it feels in their mouth. It could be a crunch. It could be the taste. And so, I mean, that could be part of the reason, but a lot of those snack foods are just so low in nutrient density that we see a lot of kids with constipation, a lot of kids with reflux, things like that. But constipation has this effect of, you know, impacting sleep, impacting behavior. If you're having a kid that's already having trouble potty training, then you throw some constipation in the mix and it's just like they don't want to go to the bathroom because it could be painful. There's just a whole mix. And then the behavior starts to disintegrate from there. In terms of treatment, I think it could just be a matter of awareness. I think a lot of people think of, you know, the outward behavior. Again, we're looking at outward behavior, but what is going into their child's body? I don't know if a lot of parents know from an early onset of a diagnosis that that is something to watch out for, that you need to continue to offer variety in a child's diet, because that is something that can be impacted. Just like they have certain preferences in toys, activities, clothing, TV shows, it can also, it happens with food as well.
Right, so parents get kind of lazy because it's easy to drive through McDonald's and get chicken nuggets and just constantly feed your kid chicken nuggets.
Well, it again, it goes a little bit beyond that to a point where we'll see kids that, you know, will not eat. They will not eat food.
Eat food, period.
They will not. It becomes a point to where it can be so specific that, these are French fries, but these are not McDonald's French fries. And so you can offer those to me all day long, and I'm not going to touch them.
That's very much. That's very much how Xander is. I mean, it pretty much has to be McDonald's French fries. And, you know, as we were discussing a little bit before the podcast began, you know, you suffer a little bit from, you know, specific foods which you prefer so much that you will almost go without foods a period of time if you don't have access to those other foods.
That's
and
true.
I was like that until about 12 or 13. I wouldn't eat anything with cheese on it. Texture and color would put me off. And, you know, Xander is very picky in what he wants to eat. You know, he won't eat something like a goldfish cracker alternative. You know, there's certain things which he will just keep eating and eating and eating, but this slight variation
that comes
from a different manufacturer, he won't have
it. Let's be honest, you and I have talked about curry before, and you try to get me to eat curry all the time. But my mother made curry chicken years ago. And I got so sick eating that, and she forced me to eat curry chicken.
Yeah.
She said, you've got to eat this. You know, you're sitting at the table. You're not getting up from the table until you eat this curry chicken.
Yeah.
And I ate the curry chicken, and I got so sick, and thankfully never had to eat it again.
Yeah.
But here we are 30 years later, and you constantly try to get me to eat curry. And what do I tell you all the time? I'm not eating curry. I don't care how well you prepare it. I'm not eating curry.
Yeah.
I am not going to touch curry. It is bad. It is evil. It's like a cat from Canada. I am not going to eat curry. So it could be a little bit psychological as well.
Well, it is. I mean, I remember when I was about 14, 15, I was feeling sick, like nauseous, and I hadn't eaten much. And so I had some Cocoa Pops. Now, I loved Cocoa Pops at the time.
Oh, yeah.
But I had them, and they made me throw up. And then I didn't touch Cocoa Pops again for 20 years because of that association with that one time. It made me feel better.
Sure.
Right.
You know, and...
And just so we're clear, yeah. By the way, I'm still not going to eat your curry.
I don't believe you.
Yeah.
Now, skipping kind of like past things we can't really prove or disprove in the medical world in terms of, you know, at this point, again, like I said, there hasn't been long-term enough studies, which I guess across a big enough sample group that can prove one way or the other on some things. What we do know is that the instances of children being diagnosed with autism has been increasing, you know, quite rapidly. I mean, in some states, I mean, I think it was New Jersey, I read it, something like one in every 26 kids is somewhere on the spectrum. But overall, across the United States, it's one in 54, according to the CDC.
Well, let's be honest, that's a big percentage.
Yeah. But, and boys are four times as likely as girls to actually get diagnosed as being on the spectrum. Now, at that point, you start thinking, well, in terms of neurology, what difference is there? Because if we're talking about a disease, which
or are they disease, overdiagnosing?
Well, that's also a difficult one. I mean, Landon, you can probably intersect on that one way better than we can guesstimate on diagnosis.
I think in terms of the idea of whether it's being over or under diagnosed, I think it's a lot like anything where there's a trend that is, you can try to say, is this something that was under-identified for a very long time, and now we've defined the criteria a little more clearly, and we can identify these things, kind of like crime statistics or something like that. Is it being reported more often? I think, there's so many factors in it. The education and early warning signs in physicians and pediatricians is definitely higher, I think, than it's probably ever been. But I don't think that it is turning into something that's kind of a catch-all diagnosis.
Right.
I don't feel that way. But I can tell you that in any day that I go to work, I see that full spectrum. And so it is a broad umbrella. I will say that. But I do think that the kids that I have, that I see, that have autism, I would not disagree with the diagnosis. Now, I will say, I mean, one of my coworkers, Laura Eisengrein with Keller ISD, she did a nice presentation about girls specifically with autism and how they can be underdiagnosed or misdiagnosed. And, you know, it comes down to kind of almost masking with really great social skills. So a lot of times girls will present differently and they have these social skills that can be intact. And so it leads diagnosticians down a different pathway to something like emotionally disturbed or even with anxiety or ADD, ADHD. But, you know, they could actually be on the spectrum. And so,
sure.
You know, but if you take one aspect like that, like if you gave a child who has autism, but you gave them a little bit better social skills, they may not look like a child that has autism.
Well, so, I look back at when I got diagnosed with colorblindness.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, that's a legitimate medical condition.
Sure.
But I still had to go through this test with an ophthalmologist. And I went to do that test, and he said, okay, here's these 15 little dots. Arrange them from blue to green. Said, okay. So they shut the door, and I've got these dots in front of me. They checked on me 30 minutes later, saying, are you done? I'm like, no, I'm almost done. I mean, if a normal person, and that's a terrible way to put it, but, you know, a person without colorblindness, sure, right? It would take you, and I didn't even ask you, are you colorblind?
No, I'm not.
Okay, so it'd take you like a minute and a half, and you'd be done. I'm 30 minutes in, and I'm thinking, I'm going to get this, you know. But you, not being colorblind, would take you a minute and a half, and you'd say, oh, here we go.
Right.
So they come in 30 minutes later. I'm almost done. 45 minutes it took me to do the first test. And I'm like, okay, here it is. They come in, they look at it, they dumped all the dots out, they said, do it again. And I'm thinking, God, that took me 45 minutes. Now I got to do it again. But after the second time, I realized on the back of the dots was a number system that was 1 through 15. If I would have just flipped the dots over and put them in order, I'd have been out of there in a minute and a half, just like you. And they would have said, well, you're not colorblind. So there's always some kind of a weird aspect where you can't just bleed somebody out and say, oh, I tested your blood and you got COVID,
sure,
especially in the age of COVID right now. You know, you can bleed somebody out and take a little blood test or a swab test or whatever and say you got COVID, right? For something like that, it's got to be so bizarre because of all the tests that are going on right now, and you're trying to figure out, hey, what's going on here? Because there's ways to fool the tests.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think that would be kind of, I think that's hard for a lot of our kids to do, and especially at a young age. I agree that it's hard to find concrete evidence of autism. I think a lot of diagnosticians are recommending, this is kind of a trend that I've seen in some of my patients, some families will go and get like a brain MRI. They want to see if there's something that's underdeveloped or overdeveloped or, you know, something that is structurally abnormal.
But you're not finding that.
Not usually, from what I've seen.
That's got to be difficult.
And so you are kind of grasping for something concrete, and you're trying to make it objective as well. So we're trying to take any type of bias that we have, we're trying to take that out. We're trying to be as objective as we can, and that's why we use our standard assessments. Those are the tools that we have, the resources we have.
Right.
And I mean, you know, there are families that, you know, even with a certain diagnosis, they will not typically, they don't want to use that, as a label. I mean, there are people that are not forthcoming with the information that their child has been diagnosed for autism or with autism or has even been assessed. It's very stigmatized. Yeah.
I read today that this extremely surprising stat, which was more surprising than the last ones. They said that 1 in 6, which is roughly 17% of children aged between 3 and 17, are diagnosed with some form of development disability. Now, it can be something such as extreme levels of color blindness, where they do almost see purely in a two-tone or, you know, whatever visual system. But, it can be obviously on the other end of the spectrum, something more severe. But, you know, my problem is that, you know, the medical industry itself, does not have a history of purity in terms of its approach to something. When they see something being epidemic, not pandemic, they want to come out with treatments, you know, like the over-prescription of, you know, drugs for ADD and ADHD, you know, giving all these kids Adderall, and it's just like, throw all this stuff, you know, the whole, you know, opioid crisis we have is because of doctors just throwing drugs at people
Now, let's also remember, what was it, maybe 40, 50 years ago, there were certain kinds of cigarettes that were okay for pregnant women to smoke.
Right.
Because if you were going to be pregnant, you should smoke this cigarette, because this wouldn't harm your baby.
Yeah.
So you go ahead and you smoke this cigarette because these doctors tell you this cigarette's okay to smoke when you're pregnant. No other cigarette, just this cigarette.
Well, I remember seeing historically a commercial, I can't remember what brand of cigarette it was for, but the guy was like, they taste good and by goodness, they do you good. This was in a time when they didn't regulate any of the chemicals, you know, which were going into, I mean, it's formaldehyde,
absolutely.
You know, going into these things. And it's, you know, I do think that, like I said, it's especially hard as a parent when you try and do as much research as possible, as I mentioned earlier, and you get down these little rabbit holes of, you know, consensus of opinion from some groups that they believe this causes autism, or, you know, this is the cure for autism and stuff. And, you know, because you want to search for every little bit of hope you can that something will help your child, or kind of, you know, accelerate or act as a catalyst to, you know, increase the speed of development, you find yourself reading these things, and it's hard, like I said, to kind of, I guess, pull the plug on some of the rabbit holes some of these things go down, because some of them do have a little bit of essence in truth, but those are the most dangerous lies, those ones which are mixed in with the truth.
Right.
You know, and as you know, Landon, I mean, Sanders had, you know, 2 rounds of stem cell surgery in Panama, you know, over the past couple of years. And, you know, his mother and I, we have noticed, you know, an effect months afterwards, you know, in terms of his speech, you know, his ability to be able to concentrate, his behavior. Now, whether that's just psychosomatic on our part and it's just us attributing that and it would have happened anyway, there's no way to tell. But on the other end of it, we still want to keep doing it if we keep seeing progress, regardless of whether that is actually, you know, the cause and effect of that development.
Right.
You know?
And the thing that I would say is, you know, you kind of have to be your own scientist a little bit. You know, you have to figure out how to use the system, how to navigate getting access to therapies, finding treatments that are effective and that can be beneficial. But I would say that the main thing that I could recommend is just don't have too many variables going at the same time.
Mm-hmm. Meaning what?
If you're going to try speech therapy, give it a real shot. If you're going to try occupational therapy, give it a real shot and work at it before you say, this is not effective. Mm-hmm. Let's try this over here.
What's a real shot, though?
I would say a minimum of 6 months. You know, you like we discussed earlier, progress can be hard to see. But the beauty of my job is that I get to see kids for just 30 minutes once, twice a week. And I think you can kind of have tunnel vision. When you see your child every single day, you think to yourself that he's doing the same thing every single day. She's doing this over and over and over again. But then I come in and I see them for that 30 minutes and I say, when did they start doing this? When did they start putting puzzle pieces into the right spots? When did they start identifying letters of the alphabet? Oh, well, that happened this week, you know? And it's like, there can be little things, but it's our job to identify and expand on those little things. And so give it might take a little bit of time. But there are so many things out there that I think you can get too many things going on at the same time with diet modifications, therapies, sometimes medications. I will say, I don't know, a real testament to a lot of the parents that I work with that have kids with autism is that from what I see, there is a real reluctance to jump to medication. And I think that that is just, I don't know, I think it's great because it indicates that, like I said before, you're not wanting to change who your child is. A lot of those medications are very, very strong. Mm-hmm. Can take a child that is very energetic and easily excitable with a lot of facial expressions, and it can change their personality. Well, yeah,
but
you know,
but a lot of those, like what Ritalin, I mean, it's a methamphetamine.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
It is literally a drug some drug seekers want to take.
Right.
And so why is that a good thing to give a kid?
Right. Well, and I mean, I wouldn't say.
And I'm not trying to put you. I'm not trying to put you on the spot here. But
I should clarify.
But some of those drugs are very bad for even adults.
Sure.
And we feed them to kids because it's like, oh, my kid can't pay attention in class, so I'm going to give him Ritalin, which is a methamphetamine, just because I'm too lazy to be a good parent. So I want to go ahead and feed him a drug and let them, you know, pay attention in class and drug them down where they'll, you know, settle down. They like that South Park episode where you just smack them upside the head and say, no, you got to sit here and pay attention because I'm too lazy to be a parent and try to control my kid. I just want to give them a drug or I want to say, hey, you know, there's this problem over here.
Mm. Well, and I think, again, you know, this kind of goes beyond, you know, we're talking about the cases where I see medication being beneficial in the kids that I work with, and specifically the kids with autism, is when we are talking about they're a little bit older and they have progressed to a point where they are now in like a general, regular education classroom. Things are going well, but they just need a little bit of a boost in order to maintain a little bit of attention. So maybe just a low dose of a medication, and that's all it takes. And this child gets to interact with their age-based peers. They get to stay in their classroom that they're used to, with the teacher that they're used to, and they're making good progress. But I guess what I was also getting at is that a lot of my parents don't just jump to a conclusion. Like that's not what I see a lot of my families doing. They don't want a quick fix. They want help, but they want it to be something long-term. And I think a lot of them do view medication as just kind of a little bit of a Band-Aid. You know, we're still not getting to the root of what's going on, and how to really implement change in behavior and language and development in general. I mean, giving medication to a child will probably improve their behavior, but will it improve other aspects of their life? I don't know.
It's like that meme with the Benadryl about why it's so effective at combating allergies. And it's like, well, you can't sneeze when you're unconscious.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, and that's not what.
Oh, and my wife takes Benadryl a lot to go to sleep. Yeah. I'm like, that's not a sleep drug. That's supposed to be for allergies. Right. Like, well, it helps me sleep. I'm like, yeah, you can take something else besides Benadryl to sleep.
Now, one thing I did specifically want to ask you, Landon, was because, you know, one of the big buzz phrases, I guess, there has been over the, I don't know, maybe last 5 years with the whole kind of light it up blue for autism and, you know, the phrase autism awareness is that there hasn't traditionally been a great or very accurate portrayal of what autism has, either in movies and on TV shows. And even now, it focuses on the very high-end, you know, functioning kids with autism. I mean, you take like a show like The Good Doctor or, you know, where it has, I don't know, it will have a news article somewhere about this kid with autism who's, you know, gone to Stanford and he's doing this. But, you know, that's not the outcome for the majority of people. So if you had to explain to somebody who had heard the word autism, but literally had had no education whatsoever, you know, rather than this misrepresentation, what would you probably in a nutshell describe autism as?
I would probably describe it as a individualized, unique, I would still go with the pervasive diagnosis that can have an impact on almost any aspect of your life that you can think of. And I think I would just, you know, advise people, especially someone that, you know, in the scenario that someone had not heard of autism before, is to just take it case by case. I mean, it's individualized. The experience of autism for each child, each individual with autism is unique to them and to their family. I think we like to put things into categories and into groups. And you think by seeing something like that, that you have an idea of this is what autism is, but that's one face of autism. That's one aspect of autism, and that is that person's experience.
Well, we all like to put things into boxes.
Right.
And it's so easy to do that. But right. With this, it's not so easy.
No, it's not. And, you know, the thing about my job, like I said, I get to see the whole spectrum. So I see kids that are not in the public light at all. They are kind of isolated at times. Their families are isolated. And it can be, you know, kind of lonely. And so, you know, we treat kids that are not in public school. We treat kids that can't go to daycare because they are a safety risk to themselves and to staff members and to other children.
Right.
They, you know, can't really go on field trips because they may run from the group or, you know, there are so many factors that go into this diagnosis. But, you know, I do think that it's the campaigns about raising awareness of autism can also raise the awareness. I wish they would expose and show more of the reality, as well.
Well, like I said, that's always like those inspirational news articles you have where, you know, maybe this girl has lost both her legs but climbs a mountain or runs a half marathon, but
right. There's
99.999% of other people out there
right. Lost,
so they never get to that point. And like I said, I think the way autism is portrayed, it's sometimes misrepresented in almost romanticized top way, like, oh, against all odds, this, but without telling somebody the odds, they think, oh, well, maybe all of them will someday reach that type of summit, when the reality isn't that at all. And again, as a parent, that's one thing you have to accept. And, you know, obviously you want them to be that one who reaches that summit, but you have to be realistic.
Sure.
That, you know, that may never happen, you know.
Well, and it's about those small victories, you know, the idea of a child that wasn't talking using single words, a child that's using single words going to phrases and sentences. You know, it's little things like that. The other thing that I think we're finding, and I don't have statistics, but it would be interesting to know the percentage of children that are in gifted programs, gifted and talented programs, that may be on the spectrum.
Yeah.
Because we're finding, you know, a lot of kids that they have specific interests. They're very interested in certain, you know, science, technology, engineering, mm-hmm. mathematic fields, but their social skills are not the greatest. That a lot of times they can end up being on the spectrum.
Yeah.
And so, you know, it's just interesting how that can kind of evolve over time and the way the diagnosis is changing.
Sure.
I don't think it's changing to try to, no, like I said, the goal is not to include more people, but those kids, you see someone and you say, well, they are gifted and talented academically, but their social skills may be so poor that if you were to do an assessment, I mean, they may end up, you know,
yeah.
on the autism spectrum.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a diagnosis that we come in contact so often, you know, come into contact with it every single day, but yet it is, it's so confusing
mm.
at times.
Yeah. Now, what are your plans for the future? Do you think this is something you're going to keep in and like for the rest of your life till you retire and, you know, kind of just branch off deeper and deeper, I guess, into the therapy fields? Because I'm sure the, you know, methods of therapy and everything is going to change, you know, decade to decade as more research is done.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously with the numbers of kids being diagnosed on the spectrum increases, there will be, you'd think, more funding into, you know, perhaps some of the alternative treatments, like I said, with diet, you know, looking at maybe some of the more, I guess, genesis in neurology, that maybe certain chemicals in the brain do automatically, you know, cause something. You just don't know until that research is done on a large scale.
Mm-hmm.
And probably internationally, because again, there's always political and economical reasons why some studies aren't done in certain countries.
Sure.
And so hopefully, you know, across the next 20 years, there will be more and more effective research done where, you know, people like yourself can really, I guess, kind of not have to do this trial and error thing, because it's not like you've inherited a great, you know, working plan. You know, it's still a work in progress when
sure.
you get all the different therapies like ABA, which is still has a certain amount of controversy about it,
mm-hmm.
and other, you know, therapies. So, you know, I do hope that, you know, people like yourself, you know, you've been a great blessing to my son and, you know, to my son's mother and to me and Therapedia. You know, I mean, we've got nothing but fantastically positive things to say about that. Now, I did want to give you a chance to kind of, again, just revisit about Therapedia a little bit and let
sure.
people know, you know, how they can get in touch with you, because we do have a lot of listeners kind of in the area
sure.
who may know somebody, family member, a
yeah.
friend, somebody they've worked with, kid who, you know, might benefit.
Sure. I mean, you know, kids with autism and on the autism spectrum, that's got to be a passion of any pediatric therapist, because you're going to see it so often. In terms of my own personal goals, I mean, I'm extremely happy with where I am right now, and I'm very proud of what Therapedia has done. Our leadership group, I mean, they're awesome. Deborah Kitchens is a physical therapist. She's our owner. Tara Brown is our occupational therapy supervisor. They're awesome. When we say that the clinic is therapist owned and operated, I mean, we mean that everyone sees patients. The goal of the clinic itself is just to provide exceptional therapy for the kids. If anyone has had concerns about their child's development in physical aspects, behavior regulation, fine motor skills, speech, or if it's something that your pediatrician has brought up as a concern, I mean, same thing with us. They don't throw those things around lightly just to prescribe something else, you know, to have something else on your to-do list to go get a physical therapy evaluation for your child. You know, our goal is not for quantity at all. We value the quality of therapy that we are able to provide, and we're a small clinic. So if you have any concerns, we always just recommend that just come in and have an evaluation done for physical therapy, speech therapy, occupational therapy. And even if you don't qualify for services, we can give you things, resources, activities, things that you can focus on at home to try to facilitate some development of new skills in an area that you're concerned about. You can always visit our website at therapediacenter.com. We have also started a YouTube page recently. Okay. Because of COVID, we haven't had parents coming into the clinic.
The age of COVID.
So we're trying to find ways to communicate with our families. And so we're trying all different modalities again, you know, so different ways to communicate. So we're developing a YouTube page that is going to be kind of a resource library for our parents. That if you go to YouTube, just go in the search bar on YouTube and look up Therapedia, LLC. It should pop up. We've got some videos on there about doing heavy work for sensory regulation, how to facilitate functional play with kids, you know, a brushing program that our occupational therapists can use. And so it's just a way to get a more in-depth view of some of the techniques that we do in therapy, and can serve as a reference for our families to go back and watch again and again and again if they want to. Yeah. So.
No, it makes sense. So before we close, we kind of joked about this before. So you talked about food therapy.
Mm-hmm.
You talked about, you know, when you have to eat. And the wolf always gets on me all the time because I don't eat that much.
Mm-hmm.
And so even today, the last time I ate was more than 24 hours ago. So can you get me to eat more?
How
are you going to give me some therapy make me eat more? Because I don't want to eat what he brings me, because he goes to the gas station and he gives me this bag of chips. He's like, hey, eat this bag of chips.
Mm.
So how do you convert me into actually eating like a normal human being?
Oh, man. We don't have to divulge your age, but we can go, you know, back into those.
How old am I? I'm 41. I'm 41.
So,
I'm 41 years old.
So we divulged my age. Those habits are pretty ingrained.
Okay.
So talk me
into eating correctly.
Correctly is a subjective term as well. But I would say if you're happy with where you're at in terms of your caloric intake, you're not falling asleep at your desk and
I do.
Having trouble, you know, staying awake.
Especially when the wolf tries to tell me stories about, you know, everything going on with him, then I fall asleep because he bores me to death.
Yeah. So, I mean, you know, we are dealing with situations where kids have had an experience like you described earlier with the curry, to where they've developed aversions to foods. They have developed these preferences for textures, tastes, colors, temperatures, flavors.
Do they have aversions to people trying to get them to eat?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's what I've got going on with the wolf, because the wolf tries to make me eat all the time.
You still eat those ghost pepper chips?
They are good.
Yeah.
They are good, but he tries to get me eat all the time. That's just bad.
I bought you a bag of bacon the other day. You ate that?
I did eat the bacon.
Who's gonna turn
I did that down? Eat the bacon. Oh, I'm sorry. No, that was before you showed up. Yeah. There was no bacon.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. I ate all the bacon.
Yeah, there's two things that I can't force kids to do, and it's the two things that I have to work on, and I can't force them to talk and I can't force them to eat. But those are a lot of the things that we work on in speech therapy. So you have to just take it slow.
But maybe you can solve that with bacon. You just You just dangle bacon in front of him. Everybody loves bacon. We all love that. Well, Landon, thank you very much for joining us. We certainly appreciate this. And I learned a lot. I don't think Tristan did or the wolf did. No. We've given up in hiding our names. You know, I think we did that.
I think most of our listeners forget, though, from each episode to the next one.
Well, hell, we forget our own names. But anyway, thank you, Landon.
Yeah.
We certainly appreciate it. And all of the links and everything will be on the end of the podcast, and we'll catch you on the next one.